Remaker's Mark, Episode 42, Gone with the Wind. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Remaker's Mark. Here we are continuing our discussion in Episode 42 of the 1939 classic Gone with the Wind. With me, as always, are my friends Andy Wicks. Andy, how are you tonight? You know what? I'm going to go backwards. Flip it up.
Great, thanks.
Smack it, rub it down. Sorry, too late. Can't say that. Mark Josting, how are you tonight? And I think this was your suggestion anyway. So favorite Civil War historical figure?
Less good right now, because that was not my suggestion, and I forgot to think of one.
What was your suggestion?
It was none of those.
This was my suggestion, by the way.
All right, sorry.
Let's say
I thought it was my suggestion.
It was all of ours except Mark's suggestion.
I will say Pericles, not from the American Civil War, but from the Greek Peloponnesian War.
I also would have accepted Captain America.
Damn it, why didn't I do... Oh.
Those were your two options, Pericles and Captain America.
My favorite Civil War historical figure is Spider-Man.
There you go. Good choice. good choice. Nice. Lee Wartime Hospital, how are you tonight, and what is your favorite Civil War historical figure?
I'm great, and I suppose General Sherman, because he is one of only two former generals to have turned down a nomination for the presidency of the United States.
Wow. Who's the other one?
The other originally was Eisenhower in 1948. He was asked, but he turned it down.
That is incorrect. It was Bob Smith.
Whoever that
Good
is.
Try, though.
Colin
Good try, though.
Powell.
Colin Powell. Nice. Well, Lee, you are a font of knowledge as always. Good man. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well done. I'm going to go now because I suck at history and I mostly just want to say Ambrose Burnside. My name is Kyle. Hi, everybody. I'll be your host once again this fine evening. Ambrose Burnside.
Whew, good one. Close. Good one.
I almost didn't get that one out. Because, you know, sideburns. Although he wasn't really just sideburns. It was his own special thing. But, yeah, he's a good man, that Ambrose. Jer, on to you. Who is your favorite Civil War historical figure? And how the heck are you?
I'm splendid. I feel remiss if I don't say Abraham Lincoln, only because there are about 20 Abraham Lincolns in my house. So I would feel like that's just a giant sham if I don't say that.
Yeah.
You've been
very busy cloning him.
Yes. I have a
very tall, low-hanging fruit.
Cardboard cutout, some busts, various biographies.
Bobblehead, several shirts, stormtrooper,
several T-shirts. Yes, so he's around, I guess.
You could say that. There was somebody dressed up like Abraham Lincoln at the Republican National Convention yesterday.
Was it Stephen Colbert?
It was not Stephen Colbert. He dressed up like the guy from the announcer from Hunger Games' cousin.
Yep.
All right, Andy, it's on to you. Andy Wicks, how are you doing? And what is your favorite Civil War historical figure?
I am fantastic, thank you. And I'm going to say Simon Bolivar Buckner, only because he was a Confederate...
I knew you were
going
to say that.
I know.
Just kidding.
Classic
Just kidding.
Wicks,
I
right?
I have no idea.
Only because he is a Confederate general who apparently was named after Simon Bolivar, who was the president of the Second Republic of Venezuela. And I just think that's kind of interesting. Simon Bolivar Buckner.
Wow. Bill Buckner's great-great-great-grandfather.
Quite possibly.
I'm just going to assume as much. I'm going to say so. And that thus began the curse of Buckner with that guy. This is fun. I like making up history. This is really enjoyable. It's a good time. All right. So now let us move on to our stream team recommendation. Andy, what you got for us for a recommendation on what folks can check out on the old internets?
I'm going to go... This is actually Jared's suggestion, so Jared, thank you, but I wholeheartedly endorse it. I'm going to suggest that you all check out, if you are not familiar, homestarrunner.com. Homestarrunner.com is a website that is a Flash-based series of cartoons from 10 to 13 years ago or so. Right? Is that roughly correct?
I think 2002 it came out.
And they have been sporadically active since then, but their heyday was years ago. However, the website still exists. And if you've never been, you can spend hours swimming around in that wonderful website and just laughing and laughing and laughing and laughing. Getting to know the wonderful characters of Homestar Runner, Strong Bad, Strong Mad, Strong Sad, Marzipan, The Cheat.
The Poop Smith.
The Poop Smith, King of Town, etc. So
Pom Pom.
Pom Pom, the ladies' man.
Crack Stuntman.
Bubs.
We could just go on and
we
on.
We could just go on and on.
Stinko Man.
Not that you're fans or anything.
20XT6, Kyle, 20XT6.
I'll just chime in that my favorite video game handle came from Homestar Runner, and that is Duck All Orange.
Duck All Orange.
Nice.
Duck All Orange.
That's right. We did a Halo night where we did food-based names, I think, right?
Yeah.
I was Baked Alaska.
When the heck are we going to do that again?
I was Lobster. Oh, I was Lobster Bisque.
Yes, you were. I got killed so much by Lobster Bisque, like twice as much as in real life.
I can't remember what I was.
You were deliciously, that's what you were.
Yeah, I'm memories. Sure I got killed a lot.
Good cannon fodder. It's good, yep. Good for the soul. All right, well, good recommendation. We'll link to that in the show notes, which you can find at mathishard.net or on the show notes file in your podcast player O choice, with an apostrophe. The O, not the choice. Anywho, moving on to some listener feedback that we got. We threw out to both Facebook and Twitter. Nobody responded on Twitter, you lack of culture ninnies. But on Facebook, we got a lot of feedback. So we basically said or asked who we thought could be recast in the Rhett Butler and Scarlett O'Hara roles. Allison Clotter, frequent contributor and feedback giver, said, ooh, man, that's a thinker. And then came back with John Hamm and Elizabeth Banks. I like that.
Oh, wow.
Definitely smooth and smarmy for John Hamm. I like that a lot.
Yeah, for
good,
sure.
Good picks. Michael Higgs, a former coworker of mine, said George Clooney and Scarlett Johansson. I like that. Definitely like that. Darcy McGill, who's my cousin, said Idris Elba for sure. He plays scary and sexy so damn well. And what a twist on a boring-ass Civil War story.
That would be Bizarro gone with the wind, I think.
It would be really interesting. I thought about that. I thought, like, man, could I make that work? And I just couldn't. I couldn't make it work in my brain as to how that would work. It would become a whole different story, which is not a bad thing. It would just be very different than the movie that we watched, which, again, not terrible, just quite different.
Couldn't take place in the South.
Yeah. Well, it could. It would just be controversial for wholly different reasons.
Yeah.
It could take place in the future?
Yeah, there you go.
From that movie?
Yes. It's Looper 2. Loopaloo. Derek Schilly, who has contributed many times in the past, suggested Daniel Craig and Daisy Ridley and said, this one's really hard. Ridley is young, but Scarlett starts out really young, which is true. Saoirse Ronan, lean hard on the Irishness. Leonardo DiCaprio, and then said, ooh, my wife just chimed in with Carl Urban. I like that a lot. So that was in line with Jer's pick, right?
Good job, Derek.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, good job, Derek's wife.
Yeah. Derek's great. He contributes a lot here, and he often chimes in on Twitter and Facebook, so it's much appreciated. Derek, here's to you. Thank you. Good person.
And your wife.
And your wife, yes. Yes, indeed. Whose name I don't know. Maybe we'll find out.
Oh, I prefer her to Derek.
Wow.
You would. All right. Now, moving on to a summary of the casting choices that we made and what the big winners were there. So in the role of Rhett Butler, originally played by Clark Gable, Mark's choice of Jeffrey Dean Morgan was the big winner. Congratulations. Well done, Mark. Very good. In the role of Scarlett O'Hara, originally played by Vivian Leigh, we went with my choice of Natalie Dormer. I'm going to clap for myself there. Thank you. Thank you. And then in the minor characters, the big winner there was in the role of Ashley Wilkes, originally played by Leslie Howard. We went with Andy's choice of Army Hammer.
Hey, look at that.
Andy. Hey.
Bronze medal.
Turns out something good can happen to Army Hammer.
Aw, I like Army.
So, no one was a big winner. However, Jer is going to be the person who is picking the next movie alphabetically. So, Jer, we don't know what you are picking. So, this is going to be a surprise once again. We've been enjoying that. So, don't totally screw this up for us. Huh?
I will do my best.
So, Jer, what is your pick?
The pick that I have chosen. I wanted to go with something a little bit lighter because Gone with the Wind is just a... It's just
71 minutes long.
Slog.
I promise my next film choice will be much, much lighter.
So I went with a movie that is already actually a remake of a prior movie from 1964 called Bedtime Story, directed by Frank Oz, and it is called Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Yes! Ooh. Oh, my God.
Excellent.
Oh, man.
Oh, my goodness.
This is going to be so hard.
Jerry, you just made my day.
I made my own day.
Wow.
Excellent choice. I am thoroughly excited for this. And,
Hello?
Hello? Jerry just dropped out.
I accidentally pressed mute on in the middle of my sentence.
You're
I was
so excited. Flailing about.
Oh, Hawk's going to love this one.
Yep.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Awesome.
I might have to have Hoff over to my house for a special guest spot on this one.
Oh, yeah, we can maybe make that work. We'll see. He did pretty well with Pee-wee.
we'll see if he deserves it.
He did pretty well with Pee-wee.
He did. He did very well. He did a good job. All right, nice. Well, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels it is. We'll link to that in the show notes, and we'll let you know where that can be. Our next movie is actually going to be, or not our next movie, but the next episode that we release is going to be your Hidden Gems pick. I can't remember if we've talked about it before or not, but Jared, why don't you just give a quick summary of what that is? We'll link to that as well.
So Hidden Gems, which we all know what that is. The pick that I went with is a French movie called Brotherhood of the Wolf. And it is sort of a combination of a lot of different genres. It's sort of suspense, a little bit of horror, but not too bad. Very much in a mystery vein, but it does have some very cool action sequences as well. It's just a very stylistic movie, and I enjoy it quite a bit for its uniqueness in the pantheon of horror, suspense, action movies.
Cool. Yeah, I remember seeing the trailers when it came out and being really intrigued by it. I didn't end up seeing it, but I'm excited to do so.
Yes, and I watch it every couple of years or so, and it's just I always kind of forget a lot of the pieces of it and then enjoy remembering them.
All right, so now we are going to continue our discussion of Gone with the Wind. We've got a few points we're going to talk about here. We're going to touch on cinematography. We're going to touch on acting, and boy howdy, there's a lot of it in this film. Talking about film in terms of length, boy howdy, there's a lot of it. And then a little bit about Southern culture. So starting off with cinematography, this movie was pretty darned impressive. I mean, I think we might have had some troubles with this film. I think it was maybe not, you know, if we said this was number 6 in the top 100, I don't know that I would put it in my top 100, let alone in top 10 territory. But I can see in a lot of ways why it is seen as such a influential, well-beloved movie. And for me, the area where it stays or where it earns that is in its cinematography. There is some really extraordinary filmmaking here. I was really impressed with the camera work. I was really impressed with special effects, which is really interesting to say for 1939. I was just really overall very, very pleased with everything that wasn't character-based in this movie. And we're going to talk about characters in a little bit. But for me, the first half, so this movie is big enough that it came across two DVDs. And there was an intermission in between, like it said, there was a card on the screen that said intermission, and then whatever it said in French on the way back coming out of the intermission. But everything in the first half, not everything, but most everything in the first half was much more dynamic. It was in the midst of the Civil War. It was very large. There was a couple shots that were just extraordinary. So let's touch on that a little bit, the cinematography side of things. Who would like to start with that? Maybe the art direction or the camera work?
I'll start.
Cool.
I'll mention the point we talked about in pre-production. I talked a lot about, or I should say we talked about in pre-production, the difference between the active and static camera. Using in comparison a movie that we discussed in a much earlier episode of My Fair Lady, which had much more use of a static camera. And we described that movie as being filmed as if it was staged as if it was a play. And that was a lot of how the art direction seemed to be done. And that movie came out in the 50s?
60s, I think. 64?
Wow. Reaching way back on that one, Kyle. Anyway, much later. The point is much later than this one. But even for a 1939 movie, the camera was very dynamic in moving shots, panning shots, what appeared to be big crane shots, things that seemed very unique, perhaps, to this time. And maybe they weren't unique. Maybe this is just our 21st century perspective on it. But I think we were all very impressed with it. There's a scene in the first half of the film when they come to Atlanta and they go to the train station, I believe it is, where they're looking for the doctor who is tending. This is where they're collecting all the wounded soldiers. And it's a long crane shot that just keeps going up and up and up and up and giving you this perspective of this giant yard that's full of hundreds and thousands of wounded men. In that particular scene, I read somewhere that was actually about every third body that you saw was actually a real person. The rest were all dummies that the real people were told to move the dummies on either side of them as if they were puppets to make it seem like a writhing mass of wounded humanity. And when you see the shot, like, it's pretty striking. And you wouldn't know looking at it that it was mostly not real people there. But again, for late 1930s, that seemed like it was pretty groundbreaking filmmaking. You know, what do you guys think?
Yeah, it seems pretty innovative. Although, I mean, like, technical trickery is nothing new. I mean, read about things that the Romans did in the Colosseum. Lots and lots of theatrical tricks were made use of even back in, 1600s, 1500s. I feel like that tradition could just carry through into film pretty strongly. But, the camera was something pretty new. And I feel like they did really amazing things with the camera. Combination with lighting, especially. Like, I think of the one trick that they go to pretty often in this film, where they do the pan up of the camera and they do that big shift in lighting in the sunset, and we look over a couple of figures standing on the hill from behind that thing. Yeah, that stuff really stood out to me.
The silhouetting feature,
the silhouette shot.
Yeah, they use that pretty heavily. I agree with you, but those are very iconic shots as well.
Oh yeah,
yes.
So probably some of the most memorable shots of the film.
And the first one of those that I saw and rewatching this film, I think I said, "Holy crap!" Like I said that out loud watching the film.
Cool. So the one scene that I was very impressed with in particular was a scene about right before the intermission where Scarlett is escaping the northern soldiers who are invading Atlanta. They're trying to get away and they're in a horse and buggy, and there is a barn or a buggy or something full of dynamite, as there is wont to be. Right.
Am I remembering this right? I believe it's the armory.
Yeah.
The armory. Yes.
Going up in flames.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So that's, usually not a good thing. Not something you look for sightseeing, whence escaping. So there's a scene where in the front left part of the frame is a horse and buggy, and you can clearly see it. I mean, it's an active thing. It's not just like, there's not a toy of a horse and buggy sitting in the front, and then there's an explosion. Like, they melded these elements really, really well. I don't know how they did it, and to be able to say that is pretty darned impressive for 1939. I'm guessing there's a couple different things filmed and then they smushed it together. But exactly how they did that, I have no idea. And from a cinematic perspective, it was extraordinary. I thought it was really, really excellent.
Yeah, it appeared very, very realistic. If it was, I mean, regardless, it was a very effective scene and truly set a proper emotion for that period of time in Atlanta. And I think led to, I agree. It was right before the intermission. So it left, it set you up for a good kind of cliffhanger or left you wanting more, so to speak.
Yeah. Yep. Agreed. Any other scenes that come to mind for you all?
There was something, but now it's gone. It's gone.
All right. That's
I'd
fine.
Like to comment very quickly on the special effects when Scarlett shoots the Yankee soldier in the face.
Oh yeah. That's right.
Oh, I remember that scene when I was a kid freaked me out.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
and it took me a while to realize like that the way that history. Sorry, Mark, I'm totally derailing you here. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. You tell your story. I'm sorry.
Say, it's just it just shows dude's face for just a fraction of a second, but it's it looks pretty grisly in that fraction of a second.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Yep.
Yeah, Andy, do your worst.
Sorry about that. That scene very much depicts the Yankees as the villains. Is how I like watching this as a kid. That was the broad strokes that I kind of saw that scene, that Scarlett O'Hara and it's Melanie that are with her are these innocent, you know, innocent women who are simply trying to protect their home, and it's the kind of the evil Yankees that are invading their home. And it took a while before I ever realized in the broader scope of Civil War history, not that the Yankees were, you know, the good guys and the rebels were the bad guys, but that, you know, the division between good and bad was certainly a lot murkier than you know how Hollywood depicted it in that scene, or even, you know, just from that particular perspective. It was very interesting to kind of wrap my head around that as I got older and started to understand more about that whole historical situation. That's all I've said about that.
Yeah, and it's not shameful, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't present it. Well, we're going to get into Southern culture in a little bit, so we'll yeah. push that off a little bit. But it's not in a way that you watch it in like D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, where you're like, ugh, yikes! Like, this has its place in history, but man, I do not want to watch this. Like, this, you know, it has its place, and it's not something where you look back now in a way that is really, really shameful. Which is, you know, there's something to be said for that.
Yeah,
but yeah, I agree. We're going to move on to the performances, and I think maybe even more so the acting style a bit. The header of this one in our little show notes document here is act more, exclamation point, all bold caps and whatnot. Andy, I think you sort of championed this one. Do you want to start off your thoughts on that?
Sure. I'll focus mostly on Vivian Leigh's performance, but I'll also look at... I think Leslie Howard's performance as Ashley Wilkes as well. And even really many of the main actors, save for Clark Gable. I'll save him for a separate discussion. But
I think the little girl's performance fits in here too.
Yeah.
The little girl, Bonnie, the daughter.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep, that's her.
Yep. And this was a style of the time, I think, that everything was so just dramatic and over the top, and what kind of is interpreted nowadays is overacting. And this was in a time when the stage was still probably a much bigger part of the social pop culture, so to speak. So that kind of acting had to be done on a stage to depict subtle emotions and things like that, you know, where in film, it didn't have, later on it becomes that's not necessary, but in this movie that is what is done, and it's done to the point where there are even moments in the film when the sound gets distorted because they overact so much that like the audio track gets it peaks, it clips a little bit. I'm guessing in the original recordings, but that was probably a limitation of the technology. But it just seems like there are so many parts of this movie where it's so over the top and dramatic, and, you know, big gestures and grandiose words and everything's a soliloquy and a monologue. On the flip side of that, Clark Gable's portrayal as Rhett Butler is a sharp contrast to that. And it could be that he is probably one of the few American actors in this cast compared to a lot of the others who were British actors, that he portrays this kind of calm objectivity about him, where you have all of these Southern characters played by British actors that are full of emotion and full of Southern pride and eagerness about the war. And he is just this kind of this person who sits back and sees the situation for what it is and how he can profit from it. But I liked his performance in that he was much more, or I should say much more subdued perhaps, in a lot of ways. And in the scenes where he did become much more emotional were more appropriate. Like when their daughter dies, and he kind of is holding this bedside vigil and refuses to leave. Those kinds of things, where it seems like that would be more of an appropriate response from the character, whereas instead of it being like a ball and you're Vivian Leigh and you're throwing a fit because Leslie Howard won't give you a kiss.
I know I always throw a fit for that reason, but.
So anyway, that's a lot to say about not a lot.
No, I like that. That's a really interesting way of looking at it. I didn't think about it being different in terms of British versus American, but I think the way you delineate that is spot on. I think that's a really good observation of that. And I agree. I think, you know, most people are pretty over the top. I would say with the exception of Prissy, the African-American actors are fairly balanced. Like they're, you know, Mammy is fairly level, I would say, not flat, but very level. You know, I mean, she sees a lot and she you know, keeps her head on her shoulders in a way that I think was a very strong presence that was very much needed and got her the award that she deserved as far as the Oscar is concerned.
Yeah. I like, Mark, how you described her as the only normal person in the movie.
Yeah.
I think that's very true.
Yeah. And one of the moments that I talked a little bit about the first half about how I loved the Civil War aspects of the movie and all of the character stuff I really didn't care much for. And that's not entirely true. There is some character stuff that I did find enjoyable. And pretty much anything to do with Mammy I thought was really interesting. And the scene where... So Rhett keeps trying to win her over, right? So he has won Scarlett over, we think, like we're pretty sure, you know, she agrees to marry him, but he really wants to earn her respect. And for a white man at that time to say that, I mean, that's something else. But the scene where she reveals, you can hear the taffeta underneath her dress and she lifts up and reveals the, what is it, a petticoat? What's the right terminology for that? Petticoat underneath her dress, the red one that she bought for him. I'm sorry, that he bought for her. I thought that was really wonderful, like showing that development, showing that, you know, she is very present and her priority was always taking care of Scarlett first. And she saw that, you know, in spite of all her hysterics, in spite of all of Scarlett's hysterics, he was there for her. And so I really enjoyed that dynamic back and forth. Anything else on the acting side of things that you guys can think of? Any other performances that struck you? The only thing I could think of was Olivia de Havilland as, what's her name?
Melanie,
thank you. It felt, I used the word matronly in the first part, referring to someone's pick. And I feel like there was so much conscience put on that role. There are so many characters in this movie that are so broad and so all over the place that I feel like her movie was meant to center everything in a way that she was kind of the moral compass.
There seemed to be a lot of emotional burden placed on that character.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think it if that were balanced, I think Scarlett would be a little bit better character. I think Rhett is a lot of that as well, but he comes and goes so much that it's hard. And then so much happens to him sort of by way of Scarlett or around that it is hard. But, you know, I thought her performance was a little bit flat, but I also think it was called for because of what the role sort of had to be, which is kind of a bummer. Because I think it's an interesting character, and the constant battle of, I'm sure, her knowing that Scarlett is in love with Ashley, you know, throughout the entire thing, she never lets that get her down, if you will. I thought that was an interesting performance that I would have liked more for, but I don't think it was the performance. I think it was the role itself. So moving on to sort of the filmmaking or just the darned length of this thing. So this was a long movie. It was over 4 hours long. Someone asked how this sat in the line of big epic films. Who asked that? And
I think that was me. Posited the question. I wonder where this sat in kind of the timeline of big ass epic films.
Yeah. And Lee, you had a good response to that. Do you want to share what you said in our pre-production?
Yeah, I know that this wasn't the first. I think Birth of a Nation was considered the first true epic film.
Yeah.
And probably one of the most racist. But
this was a close second.
Yeah. But I think this is probably among the most memorable. Like when people think of epic films, I mean, I for me at least, you know, I think of Ben-Hur, Lawrence of Arabia, Bridge on the River Kwai, and this when I think of epic films. So, I mean, I think it's definitely up there, but I know it wasn't the first.
Yeah, it felt like cinema growing up in a lot of ways. I mean, I have not seen a lot of movies of the 30s, but it definitely felt bigger in every way. You know, I mean, it made more movie than it made more money than from inflation. I think this movie is still the number one box office movie of all time. So, you know, everything about it was giant and grandiose. I mean, just looking at that filmmaking, if it impresses us now, like imagine what it felt like in 39. So, yeah. It's a huge, huge ass movie. Someone talk about the iconic like lines and scenes in here and how sort of skewed that has been made by popular culture. Who wants to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that was me. Just like Casablanca, when we did our recast of that and talked about the sort of iconic nature of it and the quotable lines that have been part of the cultural vernacular for 100 years now, practically. This movie has a lot of that as well, especially with, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn, and Scarlett as Atlantis burning behind her and her, you know, big long speech there and different things like that. And I feel like it in both of those movies and in many of those big grand movies of the 30s, 40s, and 50s that they have almost become less because of the pop culture world that we live in now or have lived in for the past 30, 40 years. And we have boiled down these movies into catchphrases because that's the kind of world that we live in now is a Twitter bumper sticker kind of lifestyle that we have. And so I feel like it does a disservice to the movie to think of it in the way that we tend to think of it. Gone with the Wind is a super long movie where Rhett Butler says, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. That's probably the most that 90% of the people that you would ask knows about it. And it's too bad. That being said, I really don't like Gone with the Wind. And I've been waiting for a good chance to say that. I just don't like this movie at all. And I
do you feel better now?
I do. It feels good to finally say that. I think from a technical standpoint, I understand why this is an important movie. I just don't think it's a very good movie.
I'm with you. But I know exactly what you mean.
I agree, yeah. Actually.
And I know why it is ranked where it is ranked, and I get that, and I don't disagree that it is one of the most important movies that has been made. I just don't think it's very good. Plus the fact that it's 4 hours long, I don't ever want to watch it again. But all that being said, I think that it really is a disservice to the movie to boil it down to the things that it has been boiled down to. I think the things that we've been talking about and how amazing the cinematography is and how this art direction and everything, that's how what this movie should be known for, and not throwaway lines that probably weren't even as important when they came. You know, maybe people were wandering around quoting Gone with the Wind when it came out, but that's not, I don't think that's why it is this giant movie that it is.
Yeah, I agree. I know that I hadn't seen this movie before we decided to hypothetically remake it. And I know that like I had this image in my head of what the movie was like, and you know, those memorable lines were certainly part of it. And then, you know, watching the film, it's like, well, now I have an idea of what it's really like, and it really does have almost nothing to do with the with my preconceptions of it. Those things certainly are not the things that I take away from it now that I have seen it.
Yeah, and it's not to say that that's good or bad. It's just that's the sort of the reality of it. And I, like when we were talking at the very, very beginning of the first episode and Lee was talking about how he had seen this because of a design class, that's why this movie is important. It's important because of its cinematography, because of what it was when it came out, because of all of these amazing technological feats and that they did, and how it advanced the film, or the film as an industry and as a medium. It's just not acted very well, and it's again so dang long, and it's not a very, to me, it's not a very interesting story. So let's not talk about it as a movie. Let's talk about it as, you know, what it did for movies.
I think at the time, though, it was really unusual to have a story where there's with such a strong female lead.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I think that might be part of why it was so memorable. I think that maybe added to its, you know, epic status, I guess. Just because it's not something that you saw all the time. You know, in the 1930s, the women were always the damsel in distress or the character who couldn't take care of herself and had to be rescued by somebody. Well, Scarlett O'Hara really isn't that. So that might have had something to do with it.
Thankfully, we've gotten away from that now.
Yeah.
Right.
Good job, Hollywood.
And I think there are a ton of reasons why this movie is significant. It was influential. It was innovative in both technique and some of the writing. But I agree with Jared that it. Well, I don't want to say that it's not a good movie because there's so much good about it. But I would say that it's not a rewarding movie. That I spend 4.5 hours watching this thing, and watching Scarlett make, you know, so many bad choices, and then get like 30 seconds of her maybe redemption when she says, "Oh yeah, I have this plantation. I love it."
that's just me. I've been swimming in raw sewage.
I love it. I feel the same way about this movie as I do about The Sound of Music.
Interesting.
It's a very important movie. It is a very well done movie. I just don't think it's a very good movie.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah.
And
I would say that I think the point of it is kind of lost.
Yeah, and that's a good way to put it too. They're important movies, but why?
Yeah, I can't disagree with that at all. I think that's spot on. And I don't know why.
There are a fair number of movies that really that are beloved by everybody that I kind of look at and wonder, okay, why is that so revered, you know?
This kind of sounds like a special episode topic.
Yeah. I feel like I need to read the Roger Ebert review, because every time I do, I come out of it with a greater degree of appreciation.
Yeah.
So that's homework for me. And so much of it is just, you know, finding out what I don't know about it. You know what I mean? Like, there's so much to consider, so that always helps. But I don't let it betray how I feel about it, but it often informs things in a way that allows me to have a richer knowledge of it, at least.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it has to do with the time period. You know, it's movie-going audiences were different in the 1930s than they are now, so.
Yeah. I'll agree with FDR that it was just too long.
Yeah. a little bit of trivia on the quotes side of things. The producer, I guess, got fined for using the word damn in the movie.
Good. Well, I mean, not good that he was fined, but I'm glad that he stuck with it.
Yeah. $5,000 for saying damn once.
Wow. That's not pocket change back then.
Yeah. I thought that was kind of funny.
Well, last but not least, let's touch on the Southern aspect of this. So this is very much a Southern movie. And in watching this, it makes me realize how little I know about Southern culture, for good or bad. Andy, I think you made a point about the politics of this being very interesting. And we touched a little bit on sort of how This is very Southern-centric in its viewpoint. Whether that's good or bad, I'm not sure. Do you want to touch on that a little bit and kind of talk through that some?
Sure. I didn't use the term Southern-centric, but I said that the perspective is sympathetic to the Southerner, meaning that it's told... It tells the story of a Southern family and their experiences in surviving the war and living in the aftermath of the war. And it doesn't really... What I liked about this is that it doesn't really whitewash or romanticize the war and life that surrounded it. It made it pretty obvious that living through the war was very hard and difficult and horrible. It's just that the characters themselves were romanticized to the extreme. And I think... I can't remember if it was Jer or Kyle, I think, that said earlier, like, you liked every part of this movie that didn't have anything to do with the characters.
Yeah, that was me.
That this is a sense of that. Like, historically, I think it was very interesting. That tells a perspective that I think, especially for this period of history, may not get told often, or especially up here in the northern half of the United States. So I appreciated that and kind of learning about what that life was like. And I'm curious about, there's another point here on the notes about, in the beginning of the movie, the Southern gentlemen are portrayed as being almost just giddy about the prospect of going to war. And then when the war is officially announced, you know, all the young gentlemen are whooping and hollering and are rushing off to be the first to enlist. And while I'm sure that's probably accurate to a degree, I'm curious if anyone knows, or, you know, anyone out there in the audience knows about what was that really the attitude of the Southern nobility in a sense, or just, you know, Southern men in general, that they talk a lot about the honor of the South and, you know, almost making this seem like it's a, you know, an insult to be settled by a duel, which actually comes up in an early scene as well. Which kind of makes some of the Southern gentlemen appear, you know, silly and naive and petty a little bit when they're talking about before the war, which I know is kind of a setup to counter the devastation and the horror that the war actually brings in the end. But I'm curious if anyone knows about whether those attitudes and perspectives were true to a degree, or were they fiction?
I was wondering the same thing as well. And that's and then it occurred to me that's one thing that I learned about the Civil War, and when I was in like ninth grade, that the attitudes about it were about war in general were that were about, you know, were highly romanticized, is what, yeah, I should say. It even was a spectator sport, and you know, in some sectors of society. And of course, when war got really, really brutal in the Civil War, then that's when the cultural attitudes changed. But yeah, I would also love to know, were the young men in the South and perhaps in the aristocratic North really that excited to go to war?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, oh, thank God, a war is on. Let's, at last, we can shoot each other.
Yeah, no kidding.
Wars sounds are like always... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it sounds like it's another question for Scott Bakula.
WWE.
I'll add it to my list.
SBD. What would Scott Bakula do?
Something awesome.
I was going to say that wars are always romanticized by people who don't know anything about war.
Yeah.
So those rituals of men, like, you know, the young men enlisting and marching off to war, that happened as recently as World War II. People would do that. Towns would have those rituals where the band would be out playing, and the, you know, all the young men who passed the physical would be marching off as they were going to basic training or wherever.
Well, I think you saw the fervor of people who potentially had no interest in being in the military, seeing September 11th happen, and then signing up. You know, I mean, I don't know what the numbers are on that, but I know, you know, there are people who have said, like, I signed up for service that day, right? I mean, there are those mm-hmm. times that people are inspired by patriotism, by defending their country, by defending what they love, right? All those things. So, I mean, I think it still can be around a little bit. I think we're in a different time now, a little bit more cynical time, but that doesn't mean that it won't ever happen again. But I think the way that this movie portrays it, although I will say that they do show a change. You know, you don't see people gung-ho about war, you know, in the second half of the movie. Admittedly, the war is not as present then, but it feels very different then. And nobody is as gung-ho about murder or fighting or what have you.
Right. You don't think of that, like, when you're enlisting, and, like, especially back then, that's not what they were thinking about. They were thinking about, like, the, you know, quote, glory of it. But
right, right. Yeah.
Then they quickly changed their minds as soon as they saw combat.
Right, yeah, understandably. Going back to how little I know about Southern culture, the whole Southern Belle thing was weird. Very interesting. So they took naps together, apparently. Like, they just hung out. That was something, I guess. Like, I don't know. It just made me realize how little I actually knew about Southern Belles. I don't know that I feel bad about it. I think it's okay. I'm not torn up about it. I just thought it was pretty funny about how, like, how little I knew.
It was.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't know those things either. I don't feel like I missed out on a lot.
It was bizarre, to say the least. And again, this is something that, you know, I watched this movie, I don't know how many times as a kid, and I never even batted an eye at that scene. But now, again, looking at it now, it was like, wait, what? They were all forced to take naps together?
It is like a little creepy.
Like, it's kindergarten?
Right, what? Right.
Yeah, and that's weird that they were, like, commanded to take a nap, and naturally they all just pile into the same napodrome?
Napatorium?
Yes.
Napatorium.
Yeah, and it is a bit odd.
Is this just what rich people do, or what?
Right, maybe it's still going on now. I just don't get to see it. Yeah. Dang it. I'd only known. There's another thing that was interesting, the way that they talked about white trash culture, which I didn't really get either, because they didn't look, I don't know, like, white trash has such a different meaning now, but white trash then was, like, yeah, sort of flagrant or very, like, dressed up. I don't know. It was so strange. There's an episode of On the Media, a great podcast that I highly recommend, that I will link to in the show notes, that talks about white trash and the history of it, specifically in relation to people who are Donald Trump supporters. If you are a Donald Trump supporter, whatever, that's fine. I'm not making comments on that you're white trash or anything, but it's just interesting, like, who is voting for Donald Trump right now, or who is supporting him. And they talk about kind of the rumor that it is quote unquote white trash. Like, that's a big component of it. And they sort of break down what that looks like. So I thought that was pretty interesting and definitely worth a listen. But yeah, that was another thing that I was like, I don't get what they mean by that. That's different than now. All right. So last but not least here, let's talk about the setting of this. So this is set during the Civil War. As we like to do often as an exercise, let's think about where else could be set. Mark, you had some interesting good ideas. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I just observed that specifically about the cultural attitudes about war, that classical Greece at the time of the Peloponnesian War is an exact match, where, you know, before the particular war, and I should specify that the Peloponnesian War was basically, you know, hot Greek on Greek action. It was Sparta and their allies versus Athens and their allies. And even though they weren't a unified country, they recognized that they were all similar. They all called themselves Hellenes, and so it was a pan-Hellenic war. Okay, that out of the way. Before that war, the attitude was basically, you know, it was glory and honor. It was possible to, I had a phrase in mind, and I totally forgot it. But it was possible to lose with dignity, and, you know, over the course of this knockdown, drag-out war, there were both sides started committing such atrocities that it just got it became brutal, where it was where or before it was mannered. There was an etiquette, and afterwards, it was just horrifying. We're talking about things like taking your captives in their full bronze armor and just chucking them off the side of a boat, just killing all the children in an area, wiping out an entire city, this sort of thing. Yeah, before this war, mannered, etiquette, honor, glory. After the war, just death, just horror.
I like your proposal. I accept it.
Thank you for that uplifting comment.
I wish to subscribe to your newsletter, as creepy as that is.
I should mention that that's the most striking similarity. That for the movie, the love story would look a lot different because it's not going to be about a woman going and making her own choices and running her own plantation. That's not going to be a thing that happens in classical Greece. It's going to be more like a woman marries a man, the man dies in war, and the woman is obliged to just become her ex-husband's brother's wife now.
Oh, got it.
Yeah. So she just kind of gets passed through from brother to brother.
Got it. Not so good. Yeah.
So, it could still make for a dynamic film. It would just have to be rewritten heavily.
I think we would probably want to do that anyways. So I think that's fair game.
Yeah. I think I would, even in the same setting, I would want to rewrite this one a lot.
Yeah. Agreed. So I said last but not least, but we do have one more thing here, and that's the fact that, this is set in the Civil War and the role of blacks and slaves in this movie. Whether it is accurate, it is not flattering, but is this a realistic portrayal? I think, Andy, you talked a bit about that previously. Do you want to touch on that a little bit more? Is there anything else you'd like to say about that?
Sure. I'm not speaking from a position of expertise at all. It's more just curiosity. The slaves in this film seem to be treated well by the O'Hara family, and the slaves are depicted as being very loyal to the O'Hara family. That may have been accurate in certain cases, but I think we hear more of slaves wanting to run away, slaves being treated horribly. But I think you see depictions of both types, but there was a scene in particular that struck me when I think it's the first time that Scarlett and maybe it's Mammy go to Atlanta, and they come across a procession of slaves going off. They all have like picks and shovels and stuff of them. And Scarlett recognizes one of maybe it's her family's former slaves. I think it's Big Jim, I think is what she calls him. and she gets his attention and he says that they're going out to dig ditches and trenches for the rebels. And he seems to be very happy and excited to do so. And it just kind of struck me as odd that these slaves would be happy to go dig, dig defensive works and things like that for their masters. It seems to run counter to a lot of what we're taught about how the slaves felt about the war and things like that. But again, I'm no expert, so I'm curious if that's accurate or if that's more of a Hollywoodism.
Yeah, I honestly don't know. That's a very good question.
It's interesting to think about the fact that the people that were starring in this movie were probably a generation past the slavery being legal.
Yeah. Hattie McDaniel, who played Mammy, her parents were slaves.
Yeah. It's crazy to think about. And then to decide to portray that in a film, not that I think it was glamorized, nor was it sensationalized. I think, is interesting.
It was neutral. It wasn't sensationalized and it wasn't condemned. It was just there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I felt it was very matter of fact.
I mean, it's the same thing that with the war itself, it wasn't the war, which was, the centerpiece of the movie, wasn't glamorized. It wasn't sensationalized. It was just, this is where this story takes place. And this is the time period that it took place. And so this is the reality of that time period. Just like Django Unchained.
Yes. Wholly realistic. I did appreciate that that Mammy, and then was it Sam, the one who saves her when she gets attacked? I think. Is that Sam or is that Big Jim? I can't remember. I think it was Sam.
It's Sam. The same character that she runs into in Atlanta, whoever it is. Yeah.
Got it. Yeah, yeah. I think that's Sam. That they play huge parts in this film, and not just as servants, but as friends, as caretakers, as someone who, you know, ultimately saves her life in that situation. So I'm happy that they gave redeeming moments outside of, you know, everything around what is a challenging situation or what was a tough portrayal. All right. Well, I think that will do it then for our discussion of Gone with the Wind. So thank you, gentlemen. That was a good chat. Thankfully, I don't think it went quite as long as the movie. We managed to stay under the running time. I guess it's the first time that our combined episodes will be, maybe not the first time. I was going to say it would be shorter than the movie, but we've had some pretty long movies, so never mind.
I think I'm going to stick around and record 3 more hours of content, just in case. Just
bonus content. I will say we started at 8 o'clock. It's 10:40. So our recording, I'd say, probably in total for the first time is less than the length of the entire movie. So good on us there, question mark. Anywho, if you would like to find out any more information about this podcast or any other podcast or blog on the Math is Hard Network, check us out at mathishard.net. There you can find show notes for this episode and all of our lovely podcast episodes there, which are also included in the podcast client of your choice. If you'd like to follow us on either Twitter or Facebook, you can do so at mathishard.net. Sorry, username mathishardnet. So please do and let us know what you think of our episodes and if you have any feedback or suggestions for future shows. So, gentlemen, this is a good time. I really enjoy hanging out with you, even if it's not for 4 hours. Until the next time, where we'll for sure go more than 4 hours. May the Force be with you.
And also with you.